This is the interactive portion of the program. We're going to take your phone calls with Seth Shostak as we talk about search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Seth Shostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, your phone calls this hour. Seth, you told me 18 years ago that the primordial soup out there was the same, and I always would accept that, to believe that, you know, there could be life that looks just like us because of that.
Well, you know, that's like saying that every building built with bricks is identical looking by the time it's finished. I mean,
not identical, but similar.
Well, they have bricks. I mean, what I meant by that primordial soup comment.
You remember that?
No, but I don't dispute that I said it. I mean, what we do know, and this is just the result of really classical astronomy, is that, you know, the chemistry, the same materials can be found throughout the universe. I mean, the same 92.
That's right.
Elements. So they're everywhere. There are no elements that we don't know about, right? The physics is the same everywhere. So if there's a soup on planets, and when they talk about primordial soup, they're not talking about something you pick up at the local supermarket. Supermarket, I guess that
it's
is.
It's not in your Campbell's can, that's
yes,
for sure.
Yes, that's right. It's not an Andy Warhol motif. But what it does mean is that on, you know, you can expect that on many other planets which have, you know, liquid oceans and that sort of thing, that the chemicals in there might be very similar. So that, but that doesn't mean that what they produce is similar. I mean, you know, look around the zoo. They're not all that similar.
That's true. What is the procedure if SETI really gets an incredible signal?
Well, if we get one, of course, the first question will be, well, now, what really, is this for real, or is this, you know, another case where we've been fooled into thinking that we've picked up an ET?
Some anomaly, because the universe does make some noise out there.
It does. Fortunately, the kind of signals that the universe makes aren't the kind of signals that we expect the aliens to make. You know, transmitters are a little different than quasars when it comes to radio emission. So, you know, that's one thing, but it's still the case that the kind of signals we're looking for are indeed the kinds of signals produced by one intelligent species, namely Homo sapiens. So, you know, you got to separate out all the interference here on Earth, and that's tricky. So, so the first thing you do is, of course, just check it out. But the second thing you do is you just tell everybody, you know, who has a radio telescope. Well, you just tell the world, actually. You couldn't avoid doing that. But you would want everybody who has any kind of instrument whatsoever to start looking, get all the data you could.
Not only are we listening, but we're sending out messages, and some people think that's not very smart. How come?
Yeah, well, there are people who worry about that. Now, to be honest, I have to say we're not sending out any messages. I'm not trying to back off here. I personally don't think that the arguments against sending messages are very strong, except insofar is that, you know, you decide, oh, well, maybe there's some planet around Betelgeuse or something. I mean, that's not actually a very good star for that. But let's send them a message. Hey, we're the Earthlings.
A bad invitation, right?
Yeah.
the wrong party.
But yes, but, the, you know, it's hundreds of light years away. I mean, a lot of these stars are thousands and even more light years away. So the signal would take a very long time to get there. And even if you lucked out and there was somebody there and they decided to on by saying, yeah, we're here, we'd like to talk to you more, you know, 1,000 years could easily go by before you got that response. So broadcasting is maybe not terribly effective, but on the other hand, I don't agree with those people who think it's dangerous, who say, well, you don't know what's out there, and, you know, you broadcast a signal, so now they know you're here, and then the next thing they do is, you know,
come and eat us.
Yeah, come eat, or just blast the planet from afar, or something like that. But that's, you know, The fault there is that we're sending signals into space anyhow, right? Television, in particular, FM radio, radar, all those things go right out into space, and any aliens that are advanced enough to be a threat could pick those signals up if they're close enough.
All right, let's take some calls here for you as they line up. Let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Jeffrey's with us. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Seth. This is Jeff from North Carolina.
Good to have you with us.
Seth, I just got through reading a new technical paper, a peer-reviewed paper, by Anders Sandberg and Eric Drexler, titled Dissolving the Fermi Paradox. It was published in June 2018. And they used realistic probability distributions for each of the parameters of the Drake equation instead of point numbers. And the conclusion they had in that paper is that the likelihood of us being alone in the galaxy is 54 to 99%, and 40% to 80% of us being alone in the entire visible universe. They used realistic numbers such as from the Origin of Life studies and Origin of Intelligence studies, and their conclusion was, we are alone. I was wondering if you had a chance to look at that paper and what you thought of it. And as a follow-on question, if we haven't seen any evidence in the next, say, 20 years for SETI, would you conclude that we are alone, at least in our little corner of the galaxy?
Well, Jeffrey, let me, your first question there wasn't technical enough, I think. But let me just say that, let me answer the second one first. And that is, you know, if another 20 years go by and we still haven't found anything, should we give up? Should we just say, you know, there's nobody there? There's no way to prove that there's nobody there, of course. The fact that you don't hear anything doesn't mean there isn't anybody there. It just means that they weren't broadcasting in your direction when
right.
you were listening.
And you didn't capture it.
And, you know, at the right frequency and all that stuff. So I don't think I would ever say that we're alone. That just boggles my mind, the idea that with all this cosmic real estate, this is the only interesting place. I mean, that's pretty doggone self-centered. Now, as far as this paper, I have seen it. And you know, it's sort of a mathematical trick where they say they look at the Drake equation in a more, if you will, complex and you could even argue sophisticated way than the original formulation, and then decide that, well, there's this very high probability that we're alone. But that conclusion, unfortunately, depends really on what your estimate is. And estimate maybe should be replaced by the word guess. For a lot of the terms in the Drake equation that we don't know. So I wouldn't get terribly discouraged by that paper. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting, but I don't think it's very conclusive.
What keeps driving you, Seth? What pushes you?
Well, I think this is an interesting question. I mean, it's very simple. This is curiosity.
Yes.
Right? You know, I was talking to one of our scientists at the Institute today who studies the chaotic behavior of the moons of Saturn. And I asked him, I said, you know, okay, you know, why should anybody care about that, the chaotic behavior of the moons of Saturn? He said, it's just interesting. He says, you know, why do people study the dinosaurs, right? I mean, they're not around anymore.
Yeah. And we need to learn these things.
Yeah, it's knowledge. It's just knowing something. And to say that that's not important is to fly in the face of something that the Greeks realized a long time ago, and that is that knowledge is worth it, even for its own sake.
I remember the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, a classic movie. And toward the end, the alien basically said, as he was talking to her, that they're looking for the same thing we are, that answer to who are we, why are we here, what about God?
Right.
And I would guess that if there are extraterrestrials out there, and I do believe there's probably many, they're probably still looking for the same answers we are. What do you think?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this all comes down to curiosity, right? I mean, a lot of the exploration of the Earth was done for, if you will, practical reasons. Columbus was really, you know, just hoping to improve the market position of Spain in 1500.
That's right.
But
wealth.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there were also explorers who just were exploring because they were interested. What's over that next hill kind of thing? And that's a human characteristic which I think is fundamental and also very important, because any society that doesn't do that, you know, they become static. And if they become static, they're very vulnerable. So I think that wanting to do something just because it's an interesting question to answer is really worth it.
Let's go to Mark in Las Vegas, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Seth, I have some real bones to pick with you. I hope you don't mind.
Just be nice. Just be nice, Marco.
I'm a huge fan of yours in general. I've met with you at some conferences and spoken with you. But your insistence on not looking at the actual data, the reports, everything to do, just to focus in on the Navy videos to start with. First of all, the Hornet and Super Hornet, okay, those are our most popular craft that our trainers train our top pilots on. And, of course, those are going to be the planes that are going to record anything, most likely, since they're most in use. David Fravor, who had his personal, eyewitness sighting and interaction with that craft, was our top instructor. He's nuclear rated. He's considered the absolute top pilot in the entire military, basically. And to discount what he said, not alone, and then an hour later to have Chad Underwood, the pilot, video, tape that same object, is just crazy to me. These things move from 60,000 feet to 50 feet with no sonic booms in the blink of an eye, and another one takes off at over 20 times the speed of sound. They're seen on both coasts with different pilots. The pilots on the East Coast, by the way, they swear, and their eyewitness account is of cubes surrounded by spheres flying in between two of them, through the jet wash. I mean, you've got things that are moving in ways. You've got radar, our top radar specialists on the Nimitz and the Princeton with our absolute top systems that are seeing these things for weeks and have no explanation for entire fleets of these things moving in and out of our airspace where we do our military training. They also describe them following them over to the Middle East. I mean, these are guys with top security clearances, top secret nuclear weapons rated, and it goes on and on. I mean, they are different craft. It's the same FLIR system, but you have different craft recording them, separated by 11 years. And the military, which claims over and over again, oh, we don't have any programs. We don't have any programs studying these objects. After ATIP comes out, after the video is released, then they say, oh, well, actually, we did have that program. And by the way, we did have previous programs basically in every single decade going back to the Roswell incident.
Well, and they even admitted that there's more video with these Tic Tac UFOs that they haven't disclosed yet. But, Seth, go ahead. I'll let you jump
in. A couple of things, Mark. I mean, I agree with you that, that this certainly there are very mysterious things going on here. In particular, the covering up of the whole program doesn't speak well of the military, but it was $22 million. I don't know. Maybe I don't know why they kept it quiet. I mean, I can think of some reasons, but I don't know. I grant you that. But, this guy Flavor, he comes back to the ship, and he says, I've seen these things. And, his comrades, who knew that he was very keen on UFOs, began playing sci-fi films on the ship's televisions. They didn't take him very seriously. There was no investigation by the Navy at the time.
That we know of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously they didn't take it terribly seriously. That's my reading of it. And to say that I don't look at the data, I mean, I looked at the video. I don't know what other data there is. You can tell me what the other data there was that I should have looked at. But it isn't correct to say that I don't look into these things. I try. But, a lot of it is essentially eyewitness testimony, and eyewitness testimony is very weak.
I had a chance last week to interview Paul Hynek, the son of the late J. Allen Hynek.
Yes.
You know that name, of course.
I know the guy.
And, okay, good. And, we were talking about how his dad went from being a skeptic, as he was the consultant to Project Blue Book, to a staunch believer that we were being visited. And that's a great story all by itself, Seth.
Yes, it is. Well, I've been on panels with the younger
with Hynek, Paul,
as a matter of fact. And I just heard from him. In fact, the other day. Not that that matters, but I'm not saying that it's impossible. It's not physically impossible to go from one star system to another. But there are a couple of things there that you got to really look at carefully. To begin with, interstellar travel is really hard. But hard. Maybe they can do it, but the thing that I think is disturbing me the most these days about it all is that, A, it's very anthropocentric, which is to say that we always ascribe to these aliens the kind of motivations that we might have. And that's suspicious to me because these guys have got to be way beyond us in order to get here. So, that's like the Romans sitting around and saying, well, we're going to get to...
Oh, absolutely. They've learned how to bend space and time or something.
Yeah, something odd. I don't know. But the other thing that strikes me is, why are they here now? Why now? Why now? And the only answers I ever get to that are, well, we've got nuclear weapons, or, we're wrecking the planet, or whatever, that kind of thing. But the aliens don't know about that because they're coming from a world that's surely more than, 50 light years away or 30 light years away. And that means there hasn't been enough time for our television news reports to get to them. And for them to get back here and buzz the skies. So in the end, it all depends on the evidence. But I have to say the Tic Tac videos, while intriguing, are to me, simply just not good enough. That evidence by itself isn't enough to convince me. So, Mark, can keep trying on me.
Let's go truck driving to Kansas with Aaron. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Two things. One is on the news, they were talking about an SOS that we received from Andromeda. Do you know about that?
I don't. No, Andromeda. You mean the Andromeda Galaxy?
The Andromeda Galaxy. They said it was sent out sometime when the dinosaurs still lived on Earth.
Whoa.
Well, that's a long time in getting here. Whatever trouble they're in, I suspect that by now it's too late.
Yeah. And the other thing is, when I was 10, I lived in Culver City, California, and UFO was between my yard and the next yard over high tension lines, and it was a KCOP news that it was a runaway missile, but there was no way it was a missile.
It would have crashed.
Well, yeah, it would have. It was just, we had high tension lines between my yard and the neighbor's yard, and at night we could hear them hum all night, but it was just floating over those lines going like a mile an hour. And until it, you know, was off in the distance somewhere.
Well,
but I'll never forget it because they called it a missile and not a UFO.
Well, if they knew what it was, I mean, you might as well call it what it is. But when you say between your house and the next house, you mean in the sky between your house and the next house?
Yeah, in the sky. It was probably 5 feet above the wires.
Oh.
That's how close it was to the ground.
Well, that probably wasn't a missile.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know how long news channels keep their records, but
they should have the video. That's for sure.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, depending on what kind of transmission line it was, if it was really high voltage, you know, there are all sorts of effects that you can get where there's high voltage. You know, there's St. Elmo's fire and stuff like that. These are well-known effects where you have high voltage, but. I don't know that that's it, but that's something to think about.
Seth, has anybody at SETI ever been told by government officials, especially when they were funding and financing, don't say anything if you find a signal?
Nope, never.
That's never happened?
There was never any policy of secrecy, even when we were a NASA project. No. NASA just assumed that if we found something, it would be immediately made known. But you would have to do that. I mean, I know there are plenty of people who are listening. We're skeptical, think that I'm being disingenuous, but the facts are that the first thing you want to do is call up somebody, you know, at another observatory and say, you look at this, because you wouldn't believe it yourself. You wouldn't dare to believe it unless at least one other or maybe a couple of other observatories around the world could see it too.
We're going to come back in a moment with Seth Shostak and take final phone calls. His website, he's got a couple, of course. One is his name. And also SETI.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And his radio show is bigpicturescience.org for more information on that. But let's come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take these final calls. Next hour, we're going to play with your mind, the gospel of science. Bill Douglas joins us, so get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Seth Shostak with us from SETI, of course, and we'll get to your calls. Seth, with SETI, who convinced Paul Allen, the late Paul Allen, to donate $34 million for the array of telescopes?
Yeah, well, I think it was largely the work of Jill Tarter, who, in addition to being the prototype for the Ellie Arroway character in the movie Contact, she also was the person in charge of our SETI efforts for years and years. And in fact, she was responsible for my being hired by the SETI Institute. I think that she personally approached Paul Allen.
I will still remember back in 1996, I interviewed you and you were in Puerto Rico at Arecibo, and I was on my local show in St. Louis.
Yes.
I'll never forget that.
Well, I remember it as well. You know, sitting there in the control room, I can still picture it.
How cool. All cool. And then eventually here I am doing Coast to Coast with you still. And that's amazing. You were on with Art before, though, weren't you?
I was on Art, yes. He called me up, I don't even know. It was, I think, the early 1990s, but I'm not entirely sure. He just called me at work, and he said, Seth, this is Art Bell. I'd like you on my show.
And here you are.
Here I am.
Let's go to Walter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. George, I just want to commend you once again for having someone of the caliber of the eminent Dr. Shestack on. He's in a class with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson or Dr. Alan Stern, and it's just refreshing to listen to this gentleman.
Well, thank you. He's a great guy.
And, George, I think that Dr. Shestack would agree with me that the ufology has become analogous to religion to a lot of people. A lot of people, they want to believe so bad that, you know what I mean, they start seeing things, so to speak. And I think Dr. Shestack would agree with me. I like to say that skepticism is the backbone of good science.
What do you think of that, Seth?
Well, I'm with Walter on this one. I'm not gonna contest his statement, except to say that I'm as brilliant as he seemed to be saying there. I have to disavow that. But I, you know, in terms of skepticism being an intrinsic part of science, I agree 100%.
It is indeed interesting, is it not? Let's go next to Steve in Florida. Welcome to the program, first time caller. Hi, Steven.
Hey, thanks for letting me on, George.
Thank you. I'm glad you got through.
Thank you. Hi, Seth. Listen, I was wondering with the latest and the understanding of black holes and the pictures and so forth, do you guys, SETI, monitor what's going on in our very own great dark rift? If so, what are you guys seeing there? Anything new?
Well, you know, that's the realm of, if you will, conventional, and that sounds like a bad word, but it's not, conventional astronomy. The dark rift is, if I'm not mistaken here, it's just a visual feature in the Milky Way. You know, if you look at the Milky Way from a place where you can actually see it, and it's not many places like that anymore, but anyhow, there is, in fact, this dark band across it at some point, and I think that's called the rift. And it's because, you know, there just happens to be a lot of dust in that direction. I mean, there are plenty of stars in that direction, but you can't see them because they're behind all this dark dust. We don't study that. I mean, we're looking for signals that are coming, you know, from other star systems, which are almost all much closer than the dark rift is. And not only that, we're using radio antennas, and, of course, radio waves go right through that dust. That's one of the reasons we look in the radio. So, yeah, the dark rift, I mean, there are astronomers who study the dust and gas between the stars. That's a whole discipline, but that's not what we do.
Why'd the government pull their funding? Because NASA was paying something at some time, weren't they?
Yes, it was a very small NASA project, of course. You know, it was somewhere between $3 and $10 million. It depended on which year you were talking about, which would be a lot of money for any individual, perhaps, but, you know, very small for government funding.
For NASA, sure, but it helped you folks.
Yeah, no, it was more money than we've had since. And when you ask why did they pull it, it was because of a congressional amendment introduced by Senator Richard Bryant, a Democrat from Nevada, and he was looking for an issue, I think, that he could present to his voters so he could get reelected, that he was trying to save their tax dollars.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's all there was to it. I mean, he, you know, we tried to approach him and tell him what the experiment was all about, but he didn't want to really hear that. And it was costing the taxpayers at that time about 3 cents per year each. So that's the magnitude of the savings they garnered.
Are you constantly looking for new technology to help your job?
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, when people say, what's new in SETI, you know, well, on the one hand, there's the astronomy. And because the astronomy, of course, is, you know, it's research and it's always advancing and there are always more planets or whatever. But the big story for SETI is really the improved technology. And you want to use the best technology because it might be more sensitive. It almost always is more sensitive, but it's also usually faster. And if you're, you know, trying to dig up treasure on a South Pacific island, and you can replace that shovel with a steam shovel or something like that, you might find the treasure a little more quickly.
Let's go to Janet in New York City on the wild card line. Hello, Janet. Good morning.
Oh, hi, good morning. Yes, I just want to second what that other gentleman said, that I love guests like this who tell you what they know and what they don't know. And they never pretend to know something if they don't have absolute proof. And that's what I love about scientists. Anyway, Mr. Shostak, you have the best job in the world, but I guess you know that, right?
Well, I try and tell myself that, yes.
Yeah, right. The best job in this or any other world. But I'm curious about Mars and water on Mars. First of all, I understand we've always called Mars the red planet, and I always thought that was a joke or something from science fiction, but it turns out, no, Mars looks red because it's got iron oxide or rust on the surface. So how does Mars end up with rusty iron on the surface if there is no water? So does that lead to a suggestion that there was billions of years ago an atmosphere that had rainstorms, and that's why Mars is all rusty? And is there, do we know yet, there was some speculation there is water ice under the surface. Do we know that yet, if there is water ice under the surface of Mars?
Yes, well, Janet, we do. And indeed.
And there is.
Yeah, and there is. It's all over the place. It's maybe not everywhere on Mars. But in fact, you might look up the photos that NASA made with a lander that the Polar Lander, I think it was called. Anyhow, there was one of the Martian landers about 15 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, that landed in you know, the far north of Mars, or maybe it was the far south, but it was a polar region in any case. And, you know, they just sort of scraped the surface, and they didn't have to go very deep, and you see this white stuff under there. There's plenty of ice, and in fact, there's an estimate that if you were to somehow, well, what you could do is put a lot of greenhouse gases in the Martian atmosphere, if that's a project you want to undertake this weekend, put all those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and raise the temperature on Mars above the freezing point of water, you will cover Mars with liquid water with an average depth of about 200 feet.
That's huge.
That's a lot of water. Yeah, that's a lot of water. So, yeah, there is water there. There was water there, obviously, and you're right. It's iron oxide. It's rust, and that's why the red planet's red.
How do we get so much water on planet Earth, Seth?
Well, that's a perennial question, George, and it's really a difficult one to answer conclusively, but the current thinking is the same thinking we've had for a while now, and that is that, you know, asteroids and maybe comets slamming into the planet, you know, billions of years ago brought all this water. And, you know, you can work out how many comets have to hit the Earth in order to supply enough water for the Pacific and the Atlantic and all the other oceans, and it's thousands and thousands, but we were probably hit by thousands and thousands.
Just to put things in perspective, by the way, when you mentioned Mars might have had 200 feet of water there, or may still have it under the surface, the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific, the deepest portion is 36,000 feet. 36,000 feet of water.
You know, that's right. That's the distance above the Earth you get in a commercial jet.
7 miles down.
Yep, that's right. But that's the trench. So the average depth of water on the Earth, if you were to take it all and, you know, make the Earth a smooth billiard ball and, you know, just cover it with all that water, it's considerably less. It's like a half a mile or a mile's worth of water. So Mars has, you know, less than that. It's 200 feet. But still, 200 feet of water everywhere on Mars. That would be pretty impressive. You'd have to bring your, you know, your dinghy.
Let's go next to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Wayno, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. And thank you very much for taking my
call.
Sure
thing, Wayne. By the way, Seth, Wayne is the voice of God.
Yeah, I can hear that.
Seth, I'm a person that believes in factual information, and the best factual information I've gotten on flying saucers comes from the book written by Philip Corso, the man that briefed the President of the United States on these materials.
Day after Roswell.
Have you heard of that book, or have you read that book?
I have not.
That was a book written with William Burns, one of my partners in a couple books.
Oh, William Burns, I do know.
You know William. You know, yeah. Bill Burns. And the book was called The Day After Roswell.
Oh, I know of the book, but I did not read it.
It's a great book, and he claims that he reverse-engineered some stuff, but go ahead, Wayne.
Yes, I'm just hoping that you will read that book, because I think it might change your mind a little bit. It's a very good book, like George says, and it's got a lot of factual information in it. He wrote it starting out to write his grandchildren what he did during, you know, the military service and the war, and after the war and that. And he worked under General Trudeau, who developed our ICBM system in the Pentagon, and he was given the Roswell file. And he took stuff from the Roswell crash to industry, and they financed those things to, and developed the transistor radio, fiber optics, and the dark light.
I hear you, Wayne, but I have actually looked into that a little bit. There was the book, of course, by Philip Corso, did I misunderstand what you said? Did you?
That is the same book.
Oh, okay. Well, then I do know about this. Yeah. So, of course, I looked into a couple of these things to say that they developed a transistor. Well, the development of the transistor took place at Bell Labs in 1947 or 48. And, my father knew some of the people involved there. And, that was done by humans in New Jersey. So I don't think there was any reverse engineering there. The whole development of solid-state physics and so forth, that it was all well underway. And as far as the fiber optics go, I actually spent some time looking into that. You know, the fact we have fiber optics today goes all the way back at least 150 years.
Whoa!
We're working in the 19th century, who discovered things like total internal reflection and all these things you learn about in a physics class. So I think that's a human invention. I really do.
Let's take Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Final quick call. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, I'm all for space exploration and the money for it if they tell us what they find. If they don't tell us what they find, stop the money. Now, the president spoke of a space program. Well, he ought to know we already have one, but he wants to take credit for starting it. So, he's too busy running around calling people socialists that want to help the sick and the poor. So I'd like for you to comment on that.
Yeah, well, Frank, I'm not going to get into the politics, but I will say this. I think the president has suggested the formation of a space force. And, we do plenty of space exploration now, but if you're going to involve the military, and I think it's lamentably, but probably realistically inevitable that we will have, space will become part of our defense even more than it is now. It's already part of our defense because of reconnaissance. And if you say, well, you want to set up a separate branch of the military to deal only with space things, maybe that's not a terrible idea. But it doesn't have much to do with space exploration or astronomy or space colonization, at least not at this point.
Seth, get back to Lisa about maybe a two-hour SETI fundraiser.
I will do that.
And you can help her produce it and bring some people into the fold, okay?
Terrific.
Be a great idea. Okay, up next, lots more to talk about. The Gospel of Science, mind-blowing new science on ancient truths to heal our stressed lives and planet.